We're doing Shemos, Perek Zayin, Pasuk Ches. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Aviel Aaron Lamor. So God said to Moshe and Aaron, this of course is after the first encounter between Moshe and Aaron and Paro, which seemed to end in some type of a failure or a disaster in terms of the cause, that Paro increased the labor. Of the Jews. The Jews turned against Moshe. Now, they're being sent a second time. And God says, Ki yedabar alechem paro lemor, when Paro says to you, Tenu lachem ofes, provide a proof. V'yamarte el Aaron, then you will say to Aaron, Kach es matcha, take your staff, Ahashlech lefnei Paro, Yehi lasanin, and cast it before Paro, and it will turn into a serpent. So it's interesting because the first time that Moshe went before Paro, he didn't make recourse to any types of signs, any types of demonstrations. He just exhorted him that God demanded that he should let the Jews go. But now, Moshe is being told that Paro will ask you for a demonstration, this is what you should do. Vayeva Moshe v'Aaron al Paro. So Moshe and Aaron came to Paro, v'yasu chein, and they did that, kasher tziva Hashem. Of course, we have to infer that Paro called him and solicited this from him. V'yashlech Aaron es Mateu, and Aaron cast forth his staff, lifnei Paro, v'lifnei avadav, before Paro and his servants, Vayihi lasanin, and it turned into a snake. It's interesting just to note that whatever Moshe was doing, his objective, of course, was to win over Paro. But you could see that Paro put a great deal of weight, ascribed a great deal of weight to his servants, his ministers, whoever they were. So in order to affect him, he had to affect all of them as well. It makes it clear, lifnei paro v'lifnei avadav. And of course, as it was mentioned before, with regard to the maka of tzfardea, specifically, it afflicted the servants as well. So what happens next? Vayikra gam paro lechachamim v'lamachashvim. So Paro called to his wise men and to his magicians. Vayasu gam heim chartumim mitzrayim belahateim kain. And the chartumim did the same thing with their magic. So they duplicated what Moshe had done. Vayashlichu ishmateu, each one of them, cast forth his staff. Vayiyu l'taninim, and they were converted into serpents. Vayivla mate Aaron es matosam. And the staff of Aaron swallowed their staffs. Vayechazak lev Paro, and Paro hardened his heart. Velo shama aleihem, and did not listen to them. Kasha dibra Hashem, as God had said. Parenthetically, it's interesting that this is some type of a prelude to the Makos. This is not counted as one of the Makos, even though it seems to have something in common with the Maka. That is to say, it's a demonstration of a change in nature, which of course was the prime element of the Maka. But we have to try and understand, aside from this, what's going on over here, what exactly differentiates the Makos from this? Is it merely the fact that in a Maka there's a certain amount of pain caused to the individual, while here it would seem that there is no pain? But that's just descriptive. Anyways, we'll put that question aside. Let's deal with the parsha itself. The question that I would ask is that you understand who you're dealing with. It's clear already that there's different situations, different types of people that you want to convince of something. For example, Moshe Rabbeinu, he said it in the language that they will not believe me. And Chazal criticized him for saying that. But nevertheless, on the conscious level, the way the Rambam explains it, that basically he was asking for proofs, which was the correct thing to do. That is to say, when he would come before the Jews, when Moshe Rabbeinu would come before the Jews, so he'd have to establish two things, as the Rambam explains in the Moreh Nevuchim, that the questions of Moshe pertaining to, they'll ask me, what is your name? So the Rambam has a whole analysis, because the question arises, what is the significance of the name? How is that going to affect anything? Because basically, if you're talking about an ordinary name that you give to something, a name by which something is referred to, a name of reference, so then the question doesn't seem to have any real significance. Because how is this going to serve as any kind of a proof that God spoke to him? Because either the people themselves, they know this name already, or they don't know the name. That's the way he frames the question. If they don't know the name, so then what good is Moshe mentioning a name which they're not familiar with? On the other hand, if they do know the name, so then Moshe's knowing of the name doesn't constitute a proof, because just like they know it, he knows it. So the Rambam gives a whole analysis that really wasn't speaking about the name as we understand it, but it really meant to demonstrate by logical proofs the existence of the being that he's talking about, and what is the concept that we have of God. Essentially, Ekya Asher Ekya, the Rambam explains how it works, denotes an idea, it's a concept of a being who has absolute existence, whose existence is different than the existence of any other being. So it's really meant that Moshe was to demonstrate before them, to teach them with proofs, the concept of the God that he was speaking in the name of, and that's what God said, they'll believe you, you'll be able to convince them. However, the next question, which Moshe introduces by saying that they will not believe me, it really is talking about a different point, and that is to say that in order for someone to believe that you have a message from God, that God spoke to you, basically there are two things that need to be established. One is the existence of that being, that such a being exists. But even if you could prove that doesn't mean that you're in contact with that being. So that's the second question, which is really, indirectly speaking, it's a request for proof. And then you see, because God responded by giving him the signs. The snake, the staff turning into a snake, and his hand going inside his cloak, and when it came out, it had tzaras, and then he put it back in there again, and then it was healed. Of course, each one of these signs, according to Chazal, has a very specific meaning, aside from the fact that it demonstrates the control over the teva. And then the third one of the waters, which he doesn't actually enact with Moshe, he simply tells him to do that in Mitzrayim. So those were all necessary, because, as I said, even after he establishes by logical proofs the existence of this being, of absolute existence, but then you have to demonstrate that the God spoke to you. And that is achieved through these actions, which are beyond the Teva, and which are not explainable except by reference to a being who has absolute control over the Teva, which is God. See, in that situation, so it says that Moshe came back, and he gathered the elders, and it says he did the osos, he did these signs, vayamein ha'am, and they did believe. And Chazal used it as a rebuke against Moshe, on the secondary level of interpretation, that Moshe was sort of hinting that they really don't have the quality to be believers. See, that situation was a different situation, it would seem to me, because he was doing it in front of a group of people that would not necessarily have the same types of resistances. You see a complete difference, that it would seem the identical demonstration, the first one, for example. It's not really clear, really, if Moshe did all three. It says in the pasuk that he performed the osos, which would seem to be all three, in front of the people. But it worked. Vayamein ha'am, the people believed. So one of them, of course, was the identical one that's being done now, the staff being converted into a snake. Yet over here, it doesn't succeed. So what's the reason for the problem over here? What is the difference? What's causing the difference? We have to take into consideration the mentality of the individuals for who the sign is being performed. We don't assume that the Jews were requiring a proof. So they didn't just accept Moshe because of what he said, in spite of the fact that there'd be a very powerful emotional desire to believe that it's true, that people who are oppressed in a state of slavery are looking for someone who's going to come along and save them. So sometimes, to the contrary, sometimes they'll just accept anyone without demanding proof. There'll be a tremendous gullibility. But apparently, that was not the case with the Jews. They would demand proof. But once the proof was presented, it worked. In the case of Paro, obviously, you're dealing with someone who is completely resistant. You see, his first reaction to Moshe, who was God that I should listen to him? He denies the existence of God. And aside from that, it's a affront to his personal power. I mean, he's not going to send the Jews. He regarded them as being his slaves, and he had complete control over them, and he could do whatever he wanted with them. Okay, so now he's asking for a sign, but you have to assume that there's tremendous resistance. So therefore, it would seem that it's strange that this particular sign is one that was easily duplicated. Because you see the reaction of Paro. That Paro, after Moshe cast down his staff, take a look at Yud Aleph. So Paro called his wise men and his magicians, and they did the same thing. It's interesting, even with regard to Pasuk Yud Aleph, what do you notice about that? It would have really been sufficient for Paro just to bring one person and do the same thing. But he brings many. What do you see from that? Was that just a gut reaction, or was that with a plan?
And prove it to them that...
He was trying to diminish the significance of what Moshe had done. First of all, he was trying to refute it. You're claiming that this is something unique, and this proves the existence of God. Here, my magicians can do the same thing. But it's one thing if you could find just one person, which essentially, if there was just one person that could do it, seems that that's what Paro would have done. That would have been enough. It would have refuted what Moshe did as being something unique. But it seems that he's going further than that. He's really trying to diminish by showing a certain element of superiority, not just that we could do the same thing, but I have many people that could do it. So with this quantitative element, he's seeking to further diminish the sign that Moshe had given. So of course this raises the question that if you're trying to prove something, it would seem, then the whole essence of the proof of a miracle, the whole essence of a miracle is something that lies outside the realm of the natural framework. That's something that can't be duplicated by scientists. A person claims that he has the ability, miraculous powers, and he's prepared to give a demonstration. So obviously, if it's anything that can be duplicated in the lab by scientists, so then we rule it out, because it's obvious that this is something, just the utilization of the natural elements. There's nothing supernatural about it. To be supernatural, it's got to be something that the experts can't duplicate. This means that the cause is something outside of the framework of nature. So why would God give Moshe something, a sign, which was supposed to demonstrate that, which Paro not only was able to duplicate, but many. He brought them all in and showed him that it's, A, from a qualitative standpoint, it's nothing special, and B, quantitatively, we have many people that can do this. There's a key word in the pasuk. It says, Vayasu gam heim, chatuim mitzrayim, belahateyam kein. What does that mean? You could put that word sort of in parentheses. What does it mean that they did it, belahateyam, as opposed to simply saying that they did it? The Ibn Ezra, on the word v'lam chashvim, the magicians, says clearly, Mishanim Dvar HaToldos Lamare HaAyin. They change the things in the natural order, but Lamare HaAyin, it's what we call sleight of hand. It's just an illusion. It's a visual effect, which is magic, basically. When magicians pull rabbits out of hats and all of that, everybody knows that there's a rational explanation. No one assumes that he has the capacity to do a miracle. It's clear. But it looks that way. So that's what's called achizas einayim, to create an illusion. And that's what he says on the next v'hachatumim. He goes through this whole thing of lahatayan, this word, but he concludes, it's a lengthy Ebenezer, I'll just go with the conclusion, v'zosi achizas einayim. So basically, what the pasuk is telling us is that they were able to duplicate it, but it really wasn't duplication. It was not duplication. Because anybody that attends a magic show understands that there's a distance. The magician is operating with magic. That's clear. It's clear to a person. And it's entertainment. How do you know that it's magic? Even sometimes, of course, they'll call somebody on the stage and look at the box, and you see there's nothing in there, and so on and so forth. That's true. That's just to create the impression, to strengthen the impression. The wonder, how does he do it? But there again, he's not going to let you inspect all the props. There's a limit to what you're going to be able to see. So it's clear that he's operating within a certain framework. He has to maintain a certain distance, and he has to have certain covers, and it produces an effect upon you because it's happening very quickly, and you can't figure it out. Sleight of hand, as they say. However, that's basically what that's why he called these magicians, because they had the capacity to do these things. Whether it's sleight of hand, and whether it's because there are certain types of snakes that can get very rigid and look like a staff, whatever the case may be, they did not duplicate it. Because what Moshe didn't do it with recourse to any types of magic. Vayashlech, that is to say, Vayashlech Aaron es Mateu, lefnei paro, v'lefnei avada, v'yihi lasanin, means to say that they did it in a manner which did not give any type of a indication of any kind of magic, something which anybody would be impressed by. So then it says that, let's follow it. So then the Zepara counters by seeking to negate the effect. And he wanted to negate the effect by showing that we could do it, but by many, many cases, many magicians could do it. However, Vayashlichu Ishmateyu Vayula Taninim. So at this point in time, it would seem that Paro had counted Moshe. So what happens next? Then you have Vayivla Mate Aaron es Matosam, that the Mate of Aaron swallowed their Matos, or their snakes, or whatever. You want to learn, Rashi says that Mayachash Chozer Venasa Mate, Bolas Kulon. For our purposes, I don't think it makes that much difference, which would be, of course, would be a greater miracle. But however you want to interpret it, even if it's there were snakes, you had the snake of Moshe, it's being referred to as the staff because that's what it was converted from, and now you have their snakes, and the snake of Moshe swallowed all of their snakes. How does that fit in now? Yeah, part two is really essential. Whether it was inherently necessary or not, I'm questioning. That is to say, had you been doing this in front of a completely rational person who did not have an agenda, then what Moshe did would have been sufficient. As we see in the case of the Bnei Yisrael, that was sufficient. But once Paro sought to disprove it, sought to duplicate it, and to maintain that this was the same thing, that we did the same thing. To the contrary, we did even more. There was the element of denial. So then it was necessary to do another, to demonstrate something else, that there's something qualitatively different than what you've done. Because it can't be that I created a snake and you created a snake, and therefore we're both equal. Because if that's the case, it would have been impossible for the snake that Moshe had created to swallow all the snakes. So this was the counter. This could not be an ordinary snake the way most people assume it is. But this is a special bria. This is a completely type of a being that doesn't exist in the framework of nature, and therefore it's a further indication that this is something which results from something beyond the teva. So what happens next? Now you'll understand something. If you take a look at Yud Gimel gives the conclusion. The question, of course, is, did it have an effect? Did it work? Did it make its point? And the answer is no. That Paro didn't listen to them. Paro did not listen to them. However, in reading the story, superficially you get the idea that the reason why he didn't listen to them is simply because he refuted them. There was no proof. Once you can duplicate it, there's no proof. So that's why. But if that's the case, why does it have to say, Vayechazak lev paro v'lo sham aleihem? That he hardened his heart. Why do you have to harden your heart? If you're trying to make a point, if you're trying to demonstrate something, and I refute you, and because if I refute you, I don't listen to you, so that's not having to do with hardening the heart. It's interesting. The hardening of the heart, that is a certain stubbornness. It's an emotional phenomenon. It means to say, without this emotional phenomenon, then he should have been convinced. Because from the standpoint of rationality, Moshe had demonstrated something which they really couldn't duplicate. So what's the pasuk telling you? Was it simply that Paro wasn't going to listen? If Paro wasn't going to listen at all to what Moshe had to say, if he was just going to harden his heart, so then we could ask, so why do you have to go through the entire a process of duplicating? What's the relationship between the two? In effect, did Paro reject it because he hardened his heart? That's one thing. Or did Paro reject it because of the duplication, which is a different idea? He was able to duplicate it, and therefore he rejected it. How do these two come together? They do play a role, interestingly enough. I want to make it clear that there's two possible causes why a person can reject something. I could just simply refuse. When you try and prove something to another individual, the Torah Misinai, whatever it is, so sometimes the person comes up with arguments, bogus arguments, but they're not necessarily rational, but he just has certain objections and he falls back on those rejections. Or sometimes he may not even have, you know, like people try to say, well, maybe they were Martians, that type of thing, some wild arguments. And they stick to that. At other times, they may not have. They may realize that it's absurd to say those kinds of things, but they're just stubborn. Nah, they're not convinced. They refuse to be convinced. So those are two separate responses. And here we seem to have both responses. That one response is, well, look, my magicians have done the same thing. That could be one factor. Well, the other fact could be, I'm just stubborn. He's just stubborn. That's it. I'm not impressed. Here we seem to have both factors, and I'm trying to analyze how they come together. You see the way he's functioning in an irrational kind of a manner. It does show some insight into how people function irrationally when they have resistance, when they don't want to accept something. So they need to have some kind of a rejection. If a person has to have some sense of reality. His sense of reality demands that he has to come up with something to refute it. Otherwise, it's too powerful. But in doing so, he's not doing it in a purely rational way. That is to say that Paro had a need to refute Moshe, to fall back on. Well, the magicians did something. That's true, but after Moshe's snake swallowed their snake, so then that should have removed it. So a purely rational individual that did not have this element of resistance and stubbornness would have been convinced, and that would have been sufficient. But given the element, given that emotion, then the phenomena of duplication was sufficient for Paro to reject what Moshe had done. Even though after you break him down to the nth degree, logically you wouldn't be able to sustain it, but that doesn't matter. In terms of his functioning, that's it. We did the same thing. All right, so then his was better or whatever. Whatever you want to say, it's meaningless. But that's because he hardened his heart. The pasuk is pointing out that he had to harden his heart. That if you didn't have that element of resistance, which distorts things, then he would not have been able to reject it. So it's really a combination. On the other hand, if he didn't have the basis for rejecting it, then he also, even with the stubbornness, he would have been stuck. Because how do you explain this? So that's the way the mind of the Rasha works. It's not only a Rasha. I mean, people in any situation where they don't want to face certain truths. So sometimes you'll have a person that just rejects it. That's one thing. But Paro wasn't just on that level where he simply rejected it. He needed to fall back onto something. He felt that he needed to refute what Moshe was doing. So he brought the Mechashvim, and that was sufficient. Even though Moshe then proceeded to demonstrate the superiority, but that's something else. That's already a different type of a claim. Well, it's true, logically, but a person that has a certain resistance is going to belittle that type of thing. We're going to start asking, hey, your snake did this, my snake did that, but basically, we both did the same thing. That's the way he was thinking. So that's why it says, Vayechazak leiv paro, v'lo shama aleihem, kasher dibra Hashem. However, there's one question that we should raise over here, and that is that if that is the case, and that is the mechanism by which the Rasha operates and the psychology, that it would seem, we could raise the question, why did God then give Moshe something which wasn't really duplicated, but which could create the impression of being duplicated? And while you could say that it really was superior, but why do something? If people are going to look for any type of a device to break down something that they don't want to accept. So you could see over here that it's something which is not that clear cut. These are good arguments for a completely rational person. How do you explain the swallowing? But again, in terms of the impact upon people, it's not that clear cut. It leaves room for doubt. So why not arm Moshe Rabbeinu with something which was not subject to duplication at all? Now, of course, as Yosef has mentioned, we do see that this is not the only time, even in future cases, until it reaches a certain point where they cannot duplicate. But the idea that the magicians are duplicating what Moshe does remains constant. And here's the first time we encounter it. So what's the idea behind that? What I mean is, had Moshe been given something which could not be duplicated? So then, of course, you still have to deal with the resistance, with the hardening of the heart. But our point was that only comes into play if it has some type of a basis to fall back on, some type of a justification. But if it was something that could not be duplicated, we don't know what the outcome would have been. In spite of the hardening of the heart, perhaps it would have had a different effect. That's my question. That's why I have to explain that we have to account for both factors, that Paro did not merely reject it because he hardened his heart. But the hardening of the heart enabled him to fall back on the validity, the veracity of what his own magicians had done, and to utilize that to counter what Moshe had done at the end of the day. So those two things come together. So therefore the question is valid. Why give Paro something which he would be able to duplicate, albeit in a manner which was not, objectively speaking, on the same plane as what Moshe had done, but which from a purely subjective standpoint, the mentality of Paro would be sufficient to give him the justification, the rationalization that he needed. And this is basically the foundation of everything that's happening over here. The answer to this question is, it's of course true, that the purpose of what God was doing is the Yadu Mitzrayim Kanir Hashem. That all the world should have an opportunity to recognize the existence of Hashem. And first and foremost, it would be Paro, his servants, the rest of the populace. However, we see from this that the will of God is not simply that a person should know him, but that a person should know him as a result of the utilization of his own intellectual powers, his ability to discover the truth. That's a recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that really entails two things. To a certain extent, you see that in the story of Avraham Avinu. The Rambam points out that he was raised among idol worshippers, and he himself worshipped with them. And slowly but surely his mind began to operate, and he began to question and think. And the Rambam learns that he started this process when he was 3 years old. He was extremely precocious. But at the age of 40, he discovered his maker. He discovered the Creator. And the question has been raised, why did it take that many years, if it was purely an intellectual phenomenon? And Rai Chait pointed out that really he was involved in two things, because he had been raised as an idol worshiper, and that's rooted in very powerful emotions, so that many people can question it and can listen to proofs against it, but they're so overcome by the emotions that their hearts are too stubborn. They can't remove, they can't overcome the emotional. So the real perfection of an individual really is on two fronts. There are many people today that are steeped in false religions and Christianity, and they're very rational people. They can be very rational in every area, but when it comes to this area, they can't be rational in this area, because the emotions have too powerful a grip. So therefore, the objective was not that Paro should accept God. Of course, God could have brought about that situation. God could have created phenomena that were irresistible, but that's not the point. That would not be as a result, there would be no perfection as a result of any choice on behalf of Paro. That's why it would seem, it's possible to say, that at first Moshe was sent to him with no sign at all. Just with knowledge, just use your minds, just think. And that failed. But had he been able to listen to Moshe, the idea of going to Paro at first, when you read about it, it's strange. What did Moshe expect? He didn't come armed with any miracles. Sounds strange. But no, once you understand what the objective is, that the objective is to achieve a recognition of God on the highest possible level through the utilization of Chachma per se, without the need, like Avraham Avinu, without the need for any demonstrations, that's the highest level of recognition. And that's the perfection of Adam. That's really what the objective was. If the objective was that the Mitzrayim should know that I am God, so the knowledge on the highest possible level would be what was desired. So therefore it makes sense that he shouldn't go with any miracles. What do you need miracles for? We can discover God without miracles. Once that failed, so then you go to level two. But even at level two, the duplication was such that it would demand of Paro that he has to utilize his powers of discernment, so that here the resistance comes into the picture. So God accounted for that too, by the second aspect of the miracle, that his snake, that Moshe's snake, swallowed their snakes. So there too, it gave him the ability to utilize discernment. Had he utilized discernment, he would have clearly come to the correct conclusion that what the Egyptians did was magic and Moshe's was a different phenomenon. So that's why, as far as the question is concerned, why give Moshe something which in any way, shape, or form lends itself to a refutation, even though it's not a rational refutation, but people can utilize that. It caters to the stubbornness. To the contrary, that's the point. Because it was the will of God that he should utilize his powers of discernment, and not just intellectual discernment, but to be placed in a situation where the emotional temptation of resistance, based upon the fact that we did the same thing too, would come into the picture, the hardening of the heart, then he should utilize his free will to overcome the hardening of the heart. That bedafka was the purpose. And that's really the challenge. So that explains this phenomenon, which is going to recur until the point where the miracles are such that they're no longer subject to duplication. Which means to say that as the plagues got stronger and more devastating and less capable of imitation, this would indicate that there was still hope for the Egyptians, but it's a lower and lower and lower level. It's a much higher level for a person to recognize the truth without being subjected to these pressures, the pressure, and to the magnitude of the miracles. What Moshe had done over here was sufficient. Yeah, for the Jews it worked. But for people with a strong emotional bias, well, that's the test. The test is, for a person, God doesn't save a person that way, in a miraculous kind of a way, and just changes them and transforms them from being an idol worshiper into one who recognizes God. He gives them the opportunities. But those opportunities demand that a person utilize his own power of Bechira, the discernment of his mind and his commitment to the objective truth and his ability to overcome all of his rationalizations and the stubbornness of his heart and his own fantasies, his own desires as to what should be real. That's basically what the challenge is, and that explains the story over here.